Good morning and welcome to Sunday Morning Public Affairs on CFAX 1070, Victoria's News Authority. My name is Bob Russell. I'll be your host today. And as always, I'm joined in studio by my co-host and partner in crime, John Jurisic, owner Harbor Digital Media, past president of the Greater Victoria Chamber of Commerce, and current director of the BC Chamber of Commerce. As you know, we have a Twitter feed. Now, John's going to tell you about that.
Good morning, Bob. Thank you. Hashtag S-U-N. A-M-P-A, Sunampa.
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 It stands for...
Sunday morning.
A.M. Public Affairs.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, I understand our Twitter page has changed a little bit.
Well, apparently it you deemed it more important to have your picture on it than mine.
Well, I thought both our pictures were on it. But I was wondering who that follically challenged, you know, good-looking man was, and I realized, oh, wow.
Could be you.
Exactly.
Anyways, this is the time when we hope our guests don't leave.
Exactly. I'm Stan.
Okay. Well, we hope you will tweet us. You know, we want your comments. We want your questions. We can't promise you that they will get on the show, but we can promise you that they won't if you don't. So moving on, it's September, and students are back in school, so today we are going to start a conversation on education by focusing on the state of post-secondary education. After the Second World War, a generation that has survived a Great Depression and fought tyranny returned home with a conviction to construct an array of public services that would ensure that subsequent generations might avoid the calamities they had faced and have opportunities they never had. As part of that, a commitment was made to invest in our most important resource and the only truly renewable resource we have, our human resources. Existing educational institutions were expanded, new ones were built, with the focus of this massive public expenditure being to provide access for those to come with the opportunity to create or invent their own futures and in the process create a better world. But by the mid-1980s, mounting government debt and downward pressure on taxes resulting from globalization, fiscal restraint started to replace the provision of public infrastructure and services as government's prime directive. Our public post-secondary sector was not exempted, whereas in 1985, provincial government operating grants covered between 80 and 85% of the cost of a university education. Outside of Quebec, that number has dropped to below 50%. And whereas tuition used to cover between 8 and 12% of the cost, today it covers somewhere between 30 and 40%. This gives rise to a lot of questions and issues, not the least of which being, is our post-secondary education system, in fact, still a public system? A huge subject we will be assisted with today by a number of people. Joining us in studio is she with the politically convenient name, Victoria City Councillor and community activist, Lisa Helps. Lisa, always a pleasure.
Good morning.
Also in studio is Dale Gann, a man I normally think of as Connor's dad, but today he's here because he's president of Technology Parks at Vancouver Island Technology Park and Marine Technology Center. Welcome, Dale, and thanks for being here.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Good morning, everyone.
And joining us by telephone is Danielle Egan, a Vancouver-based writer and contributing editor for Vancouver Magazine and the Taiyi. Danielle, thank you for joining us.
Hi, you're welcome.
I'd like to start with you. You wrote a great piece in the July 3rd issue of BC Business Magazine that asked the question, who's steering the direction of public post-secondary education in the province? What prompted you to write it?
Well, it started, I guess, by the fact that I attended UBC in the early 90s. I was doing an arts degree, and I really didn't notice any major changes on that campus over the years, over the decades. But it started to happen in the mid-2000s when they really started to build up market housing on campus, so condos and high-rises cropping up everywhere. And ever since then, UBC has looked more like a construction site than anything else. Mm-hmm. And in the more recent years, it's been for faculty housing, student housing, but also new faculty buildings. And I started to wonder, well, where are they getting this money? And I noticed that a lot of the names of these new buildings were named after wealthy benefactors, donors to the university. So when the managing editor at BC Business asked me to look into the topic, I found it was a trend all over Canada. And now you have the significant, like the majority of business schools in Canada are named after wealthy individuals. And you see branding everywhere. So you would see, it was really common to see signage even in the school library of corporate donors, study labs named after corporate donors. And so that was very interesting. But as I was researching this, obviously it immediately became apparent that provincial funding had gone down quite dramatically. So you see that that makes them a little bit more vulnerable to these private public partnerships. So that's what got the ball rolling, and it really sort of became a chicken and egg question. So, you know, which came first, the lack of funding, the funding cuts from the government, mm-hmm. or the private sort of invasion on campuses? And mm-hmm. so that became part of the question. And obviously, as you mentioned, the tuition fees skyrocketing. So you have universities branding themselves as these world-class institutions, especially the big schools, and the high-quality education. But at the same time, you're seeing oversized classes. You're seeing the faculty members grumbling a lot about being overworked. And then you obviously see the implications of these private partnerships as well. So it was a really interesting topic and very complex. I mean, I really just scratched the surface in that article.
So, Danielle, Lisa here. First of all, for those who are listening and want to read Danielle's excellent article, if you put in hashtag SunAmpa, I tweeted it out just before we got on the air, so you can follow along in print as well as on the air here. Danielle,
you're amazing.
It was a very good article. I want as many people as possible to read it. I'm struck by what you're saying. It's interesting, a whole series of things. But first is, do you think that there's a difference, and we'll just get into the can of worms right away, from an individual benefactor versus a corporate benefactor? Is there an ethical difference? Does that resonate at all? Did you find any?
I think there would be. I mean, a lot of the fundraising done at universities is through alma mater societies, so mm-hmm. alumnus give small donations. But when you're talking about the corporate and the private industry donations, they're called the big gives for a reason. They're multi-million dollar deals. So a lot of the deals are done behind closed doors. So the public can't really look at these contracts with these private partnerships. And, there have been some controversies over the years over some of these. I know at the Rotman School, there was a lot of controversy around it. So basically you have these private donors who spend multi-millions of dollars and they expect some kind of return. And it's not just seeing their name in big lights. It's, they want other return. So that becomes really interesting. So there is a big difference, I think, between, you giving something to your school, you maybe a couple of $1,000, and obviously a corporation spending about $500,000.
Yeah, but what I'm getting at, I mean, though, is buildings named after people versus buildings named after corporations.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think they're really about the same. I think, you know, a lot of students would have to research who was Sauder. You know, who was this guy? He's a forestry tycoon. So you'd have to look into who's behind the name. You have someone like Allard Hall. It's a brand new law faculty at UBC. Big, beautiful, shiny new building. Well, he has a very interesting history. So you have to look at the history of these individuals and find out what they've done. At corporate, obviously, you know that Labatt Hall is named after the beer company. You're not really sure what their deal with the university is, but I think they're equally interesting and equally fraught with issues.
We just have to take a quick break, Danielle. We'll be back in a second, continuing to talk about post-secondary education.
From the CFAX 1070 Community Cruiser, here's what's happening.
Light the Night happens Saturday evening, September 22nd at UVic's Parking Lot 10. Each year in communities across Canada, teams, families, friends, co-workers, and local and national corporations come together to raise funds for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society of Canada's Light the Night Walk events and bring help and hope to people battling blood cancers. The 18th Annual Victoria Women's Show and Wellness Expo runs Saturday, September 22nd and Sunday, September 23rd at Perks Rec Center. It's the ultimate weekend for fun and shopping, entertainment and fitness workshops, and wellness. Check out the Victoria Symphony's Best of Brian Jackson, featuring classics such as Chariots of Fire, Phantom of the Opera, and more. Performances run September 20th to 22nd. Find out more, CFAX1070.com.
Watch for our Mini Cooper Clubman at local events. Sponsored by Mini Victoria and Windsor Plywood. From Victoria's News Authority, CFAX 1070.
Okay, Victoria, I've seen you line up for blocks to save 10 cents a liter on gas. I know you like a deal, so when it's time to sell your real estate, let's discuss how you can save thousands in realty fees. This is Kevin Ramsey, realtor with Fair Realty and SweetHomeVictoria.com. I will get top dollar for your property, I won't cut the buyer's agent's commission, and I won't sacrifice any marketing. And my rates reduce further when you sell quickly or when I find the buyer. In short, my commissions make sense. Visit my office at 1564 Fort Street or contact me through SweetHomeVictoria.com.
Thank you for holding. Your call is important to us. All our calls are answered in priority sequence. Please hold. We will answer you shortly.
When you need your windshield replaced, don't phone a call center in another part of the country. Call First Response Glass. They're the largest local glass shop in Victoria. And local means locally owned and operated, with personal service and someone you can talk to right away. Hassle-free and with a courtesy car available, First Response Glass fixes it.
You've planned your international trip.
Yeah.
You're ready to go.
Yeah.
You've gotten your vaccines. It's not too late. Get it done at the Victoria Travel Clinic and People's Pharmacy. They offer a full range of travel services, including vaccines, a review of your itinerary, health assessment, and education on the prevention and self-treatment of travel-related diseases. Pick up what you need from their full range of natural and quality products. The Victoria Travel Clinic at People's Pharmacy. Visit today at Fairfield Road and Moss Street. Online at victoriatravelclinic.com.
Whether it's snowmageddon, windpocalypse, or a boringly nice day, weather you can count on. If it's happening, it's here. Victoria's News Authority, CFAX 1070.
Welcome back. You're listening to Sunday Morning Public Affairs on CFAX 1070, Victoria News Authority. We're talking about post-secondary education question this morning, and Dale Gann has a question for you, Danielle.
Good morning, Danielle. Thanks for that that sort of preamble into this conversation on post-secondary education. I'd just like to bring this back a little, if I can, to the nation, looking at Canada and saying, you know, in the year 2012, how are we managing our post-secondary education systems to maintain a global competitiveness? How are we doing to compete against the other nations about the most important thing, which is our greatest natural resource, which is our people? And one statement I'd like to make is, you know, as Bob introduced the show, Canada made a bold statement to make education and post-secondary education a priority for our nation. But as we advance further forward, it's not up to just the government to fund these. It's not just up. It's not going to be successful post-secondary education in an environment where, principally, I believe it takes a neighborhood to build a community, which means it takes each and every one of us to say that post-secondary education is a priority as an economic and an improvement to social being in this country. And we have to come back and figure out who has a principal role in this. How do we fund this? How do we sustain it? And I think your example that you've come up with in talking about funding from private sources, whether it's private individuals or corporations, is part of that ecosystem of the neighborhood that has to get behind post-secondary education systems. And so I think you've raised an interesting point and pointed a question, but I think we have to step back and ask this. How is it are we going to maintain a global competitive nation where we're known as a bright resource of talented people? And whose responsibility is it to get behind the development of those institutions to better our communities? Mm-hmm. And I think there are players that have to come to the table, which I believe is encapsulated in this statement again. It takes a neighborhood to build a community.
Yeah, I agree, and I found it very interesting as well. I mean, all of this was news to me, that the government funding cuts had gone down in the first place. So I think that parents, it's really interesting, parents are sending their 17-year-olds away to school, and a lot of parents are paying for their children's educations, even more so now than I think ever. And they don't know what these kids are going into. So I agree with you that it has to be a grassroots community engagement. But we also need to have more of a discussion with the people kind of in the middle of it. That's why I was really surprised that administrators and faculty really haven't kind of raised the flag on this to the public in beforehand. So you get into the issue of whether universities are still sort of bubbles. That they're still in a little bit of an ivory tower state. They don't communicate what's going on to the public, and the public doesn't really know what's happening and doesn't really seem that interested until maybe they get caught up in some of these news stories.
Well, I think one thing to think about is as Canada, we do a lot of amazing things individually, and what has to happen better is we have to do it within a shared vision. And so I think that your questions are very good, and I know Lisa wanted to dovetail in there. She's sort of kicking me under the table.
I'm not kicking you.
Yeah,
I'm madly scribbling in my tiny notebook. So two things struck me, and I think that the Dale's right. We need to look at the national scene and the international scene, in fact. And also, I couldn't agree more that it takes a neighborhood to raise a community. It takes a neighborhood to build a university, perhaps, and that does need to involve everybody. One of the things that I'm interested in is the difference between a corporate donor naming a building, because arguably we need people to build buildings, and a corporate donor driving some aspect of the research. And what is that fine line? Because that's something to look at. And so your thoughts or anyone's thoughts on that. And then I have some more to say about universities as bubbles, because I think that that's something that's significantly changing.
Well, I think one of the issues with the corporate funding and with what is the difference, I mean, it's obviously a different ballgame when you're talking about research funding versus naming a building. But yeah, they do. One of the problems is these contracts aren't available to the public, so we don't know. And many of the people I spoke with said, well, it was basically a verbal agreement. And I find that hard to believe. If a donor's spending $15, $20 million, it's not going to be just a verbal contract.
No.
That's not possible.
No.
So there's a lack of transparency with these deals that's very concerning. And as soon as you can't see these contracts, you start to wonder, what are these contracts? What are the details?
Is it not the case, though, that as you know, people, you know, like yourself writing articles like this and people starting to take note of this, you know, the people are now starting to ask questions, and now that they're asking questions, that information is actually, you know, coming available, and that, you know, these are publicly funded institutions, and if someone says, you know, hey, what's going on there, the information, we had an instance for recently, I think it was Carleton or University of Ottawa, where I forget who it was who came in and wanted to establish an institute. And it became quite a public debate. They wanted to, pick five of the faculty and in return for their funding, and they wanted to target some of the research and so on and so forth. So the discussion started. I think, would it not be the case, Danielle, that what has been happening is this has been going on and no one's been bothering to ask the question. And that's why the information's not out there and part of discussion.
I think that's more of the point, is that someone hasn't asked a question, because there are departments that are set up in the university for donations. And it doesn't matter. Down to the smallest number. And the accountability and transparency, I believe, I don't work in the department, but I know there's a system. Everything from the Peter Gustavson School of Business here in Victoria, or the Cyril Gill Business School funding, or the Dr. Don Ricks funding that's gone into BC Cancer and other universities. You can call up the university, I'm sure, today and talk to somebody and have a clear response about how that happens. There are rules to do that, and that is something the university takes very seriously, because they realize that they are part of a community, and there are optics to it, and that's I don't believe that it's done in a way today where we cannot find out the who, what, where, and how.
No, well, that's actually not true, because there are cases, a case right now that's going through, that's been going through Freedom of Information probably for the past 6 years or so at UBC on some of their internal groups that operate like crown corporations within the university. And a few journalists have actually tried to get the contracts, the nitty-gritty on these organizations, how much money they're bringing in, what their salaries are like, and they've been rejected right down the line. I think the last case was it went to the Supreme Court and it was rejected again. So there isn't a lot of clarity with this, and people who've tried to do it have actually been silenced or have been disallowed from getting those documents. And a similar thing happened at SFU with Goldcorp. SFU, Goldcorp is the mining giant, and they spent about $10 million on a new faculty down at Woodward Center. And the same thing happened. It was kind of done before the students and the faculty really knew about it. Mm-hmm. And then there was obviously a public outcry afterwards. What does this deal entail? So yeah, it happens all the time.
But universities and colleges are, what is their status under the provincial access to information legislation? Does anyone know, or?
Well, they are supposed to provide information, and sometimes it does have to go through Freedom of Information. Sometimes it's not readily available. They are beholden to the public, but they have these organizations within. So somewhere like UBC, they have a company called UBC Properties Trust that develops their housing and their infrastructure on campus. So that's an organization, a quasi-corporation within UBC that doesn't play by the same rules and doesn't have to provide the same kind of public disclosure.
Danielle, John Jurisic here. I think of me now as the average Joe. Okay, average John.
Okay. and just to be clear, you know, Danielle, John is anything but average.
So I'm sitting listening and need a bit of help with the sort of following framework. We listen to governments talk about a unending need for education revenue to fund our education needs. And governments on the one side of the ledger indicating that, in fact, there is no money left. And on the other side indicating that, in fact, this is a priority and we need to find a lot of money. So in the whole scope of things, how does the corporate donation impact that equation? As a taxpayer, is it fair for me to say, well, if universities are successfully funding a portion of their activity through corporate donations, perhaps less taxpayer money should be provided that way? Mm-hmm. How are we supposed to sort of contextualize all of this stuff?
Well, I think that's the issue. I mean, that's really the problem, is that to some degree what we've had is you know, an evolution and change in the manner in which, you know, education is being funded without a public discussion as to, you know, what the public's interests are in that, what does it mean for our educational system, how our educational system is changed and changing as a result of that. And that's what we need to have, is we need to have a discussion. So we go back to, you know, Lisa's questions about, you know, about what's the difference between, you know, so-and-so person, human being saying, I want to put my name on a building and this is my alma mater and I'm going to just give them some money because I think that's a great thing, or corporate donor who's coming in and is looking not only for, you know, the visibility and whatever it gets from that, but is also looking for some return on that. You know, what are the implications of that? I mean, from my perspective, I look at it and say, well, you know, the more a university or any educational institution is aware of the interests and priorities of its community, the better. But if they are being driven to respond to those priorities because they have no choice, that they have to go there to get their money because government is retracting and giving them no option but to go in that direction, then their priorities are being skewed. because there has to be balance. There has to be balance. There has to be a place for, you know, good old-fashioned peer research and other things. And so the question I ask is are we getting out of balance? And is there anyone out there, and if so, who is it, that takes responsibility for maintaining that balance and actually having an end goal here?
So first, I want to jump in here. Couple things. First of all, education and knowledge-based economy, I believe, should be a national priority, and it should not be divided down into the delegation of 13 different provinces in Canada. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the, I'll say one word, and then we'll pick it up after the break. Collaboration.
Yeah.
Okay? Collaboration. It takes that. Let's just come back to that word after the break.
Okay. We'll enjoy that because as someone who had to spend far too much time in his early public service career attending far too many meetings of the Council of Ministers of Education Canada, believe me, I would love to talk about that topic. We just have to take a quick commercial break.
Are you prepared for the fact the government may claim a large portion of your estate? This is Robin Muir of Hatch & Muir. Assets like your cottage, stocks, mutual funds, and other investments left your heirs may be subject to large capital gains taxes. These taxes have to be paid before your heirs receive anything. We've helped many clients implement cost-effective ways to ensure their beneficiaries receive full value. Protect your estate. Call 953-6816 or visit hatchmuir.com. Hatch & Muir, we can help you.
Shop, spin, and win with Save-On Foods for a chance to win a Caribbean cruise for four and more great prizes. Plus, get assorted Coca-Cola products, packs of 12 cans, card price two for $8. Or Kraft Cracker Barrel cheese, 600 or 700 grams, card price just $7.99 each, limit of two. Visit Save-On Foods and shopandspin.com for complete details. Save-On Foods, BC's very own since 1915.
Okay, ladies, I say a phrase, you tell me bathtub or shower. A nightmare to clean.
Bathtub.
Correct. Hard to get in and out of.
Bathtub.
Right again. What you'd much rather have in your bathroom.
George Clooney. I mean, a shower with George Clooney.
Replace your awkward bathtub with an accessible modern shower. Island Marble can do it for less than $5,000, and you may qualify for a rebate. Call today for a free estimate. Victoria's Island Marble, your bath and kitchen experts.
Please join me, Dr. Harlow Hollis, and the Dermaspot team for our 13th anniversary celebration. Stop by our open house from 3 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, September the 27th, where you will enjoy refreshments, mini-spa treatments, and live demonstrations. You will also be entered to win exciting hourly prizes and a chance to win our grand prize valued at $2,500.
Attend Dermaspa's 13th anniversary celebration open house at 1830 Oak Bay Avenue or visit them online at dermaspa.ca for more info.
Bolin Books Hillside Center is Victoria's community bookstore, bringing you the best books from around the world for more than 35 years. This week at Bolin Books,
Mortality by Christopher Hitchens. Based on his columns in Vanity Fair that chronicled his year and a half battle with cancer, Mortality is Hitchens at his most honest and reflective. Mortality is available now at
Bolin Books, Victoria's community bookstore in Hillside Center. Call the Bolin Book Line at 595-READ.
Hey, it's Ryan. With autumn here, we need to start thinking about fall gardening. Jeff DeYoung, host of CFAX 1070's Gardening 101, is on the next show.
Afternoons with Ryan Price on CFAX 1070.
Welcome back. You're listening to Sunday Morning Public Affairs on CFAX 1070, Victoria's News Authority. We've been talking about post-secondary education, starting off with talking with Danielle Egan about a very good article she did in BC Business Magazine. Danielle's going to stay on the line with us. We're now going to shift our focus and attention a little bit to Dale Gann, who I introduced at the start of the show. He's in the studio here with us. Dale is the president of the Technology Parks at Vancouver Island Technology Park and Marine Technology Center. So let's just start off, Dale, with some basic information for our listeners. Explain to me what it is you do.
What is it I do?
Yes.
So let's just look at Canada, and we'll come back to our backyard here really quickly. So Canada has had in its history for the last 25 years this idea of a research technology park. They were initially started and are currently serving this most important role. Basically, a place to encourage business and the commercialization and transfer of knowledge from an idea to the marketplace. And 25 years ago in Saskatchewan, they started a park and a place, a place and a door that you could walk through and get assistance to do that. If we move forward to now, now there's 26 coast to coast. They're all led and operated by the universities in our country. And they work as a hub in each backyard. They foster relationships. They bridge and build relationships with industry, academia, and government. They help the students get mentors and exposure to opportunity. Of those parks, there's 50,000 employees, 1,000 companies, and they contribute over $4 billion in salaries a year to Canada. So let's go here to Victoria. 10 years ago, we took a surplus government asset and said, what are we going to do with it? We said we needed an economic improvement to our community, and so we wrote a business case to develop the tech park. 10 years ago, we opened the doors, and I can say going forward over those 10 years, we took that physical asset and created a place that now is home to 31 companies, 1,300 employees. And all of these companies that have come into the park started with one or five or 10. They've grown to more. They've hired students, which is on the retention side. They've attracted inbound bright minds. They've attracted foreign and direct investment. They've applied for research funding to create a science platform to enable something to happen. And now it's basically an asset in our community here in the Capital Regional District that contributes $380 million to the economy. Mm-hmm. The important part about parks and the knowledge-based economy, when I take the sliver of technology, that they're making a great contribution to our city. We just finished celebrating Experience Tectoria, where we had visitor venture capitalists in the community, and we had our ecosystem out and showed off what we have here. And I think, Bob, one of the things that we have to frame to the listeners is that we need to tell our story more. We've got so many successes that have, at the root of it, come from the post-secondary education system, the K-12, the colleges and the universities. Mm-hmm. Because every one of these companies, as you all know, is generated by the talent. Mm-hmm. The talent creates the idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Explain exactly the nature of the relationship with the university. The university owns the tech park?
Yep, that's 100% correct. So what we did was, it was a government asset. Mm-hmm. It was under the BC Building Corporation mandate initially. We renovated it, converted it, got it going, mm-hmm. and then we said the right steward of these is the University of Victoria. So it was put into a private company, okay. A trust.
One question I have is, and maybe you could talk a little bit or just sort of comment on the balance between the degree to which the tech park, you know, serves as a vehicle to bring research dollars into the university in one direction, and on the other hand, as a vehicle to take ideas from the university and commercialize them into the private sector.
Okay, great question. Let's just frame this up for the audience. Here in Victoria, the University of Victoria particularly brings in an annual funding of about $100 million in research. And that funding is then spread in and spent on science projects and research projects. The tech park is set up in part of this ecosystem, and it goes both ways. It's not from the university out to the world only. It's a two-way street. And essentially, our role is to work with helping discover on campus bright minds, professors, and ideas, and help nurture them into a commercial application. So, for example, the business school that's been developed over the last few years, it's saying to students, go and build a company. Don't just go and look for a job. The technology tech transfer office is saying, let us help you partner with industry with that idea, students. The university's tech park is a physical environment that we can host those meetings, We can create space for those, and we can nurture and continue what has started as a kernel of an idea on campus. And again, we work both ways. It's industry onto campus and campuses out to industry.
This is great. And one of the things that I really appreciate about what you're saying is we talked earlier about our universities in a bubble. Well, clearly the Tech Park relationship with the university, there's no bubble there. There's this real strong connection between the university and the community. And the other neat thing is that I think we're moving in a direction where we need to stimulate and build entrepreneurs. I mean, that was the way of the past, and it's the way of the future again. And I think that that's really, really exciting.
So awesome point, and I'm glad you raised it. So we just had a young lady in Victoria called her name is Victoria Lennox, and she's leading a tremendous charge across Canada right now called Startup Canada.
Yeah.
And Victoria was here over the last 4 days, and she's been in the last 66 months in 60 cities, and she's in the West Coast at the end of her run, going out there and celebrating and recording all the great things we're doing as entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. in an effort to raise this whole culture of entrepreneurship. We have so many stories to tell. We have so many ingredients that are there that work well. It's really what needs to happen is this shared vision and us starting to get on and get things happening. We've got all the ingredients to make the soup. We're doing it individually really well. We now have to move to the stage of collectively doing it really well, a shared vision.
But Dale, you also have to always have in mind this issue of access to post-secondary education. So you can say, okay, it's great right now, it looks healthy, we have these people from the past 20 years that have really profited from this university industry liaison, but what about all of the low-income kids right now that can't get into university, that are going to end up, maybe if they're lucky, going into a trade? So if you want to inspire entrepreneurship, you really have to start with having an even playing field for all Canadians and for international students as well. So with tuition fees going up so much, the worry is that a lot of these lower-income kids that can't afford it, low- to middle-income kids, won't have access to university to brighten their minds so that they can go into these private sector
partnerships. Danielle, I couldn't agree with you more, and it's interesting. I got all excited about entrepreneurship, and one of the things that I think, though, is the other side of the coin is exactly that you say. So first of all, there needs to be better access, and we can discuss later in the show how we create that. But the second thing is, and I feel really strongly about this, I come from a liberal arts background. I didn't do any tech thing, and when Dale talks about from idea to marketplace or help make commercial approaches or the commercialization of ideas, I think that's great and it's needed. But there's also the other side. I come from, like, you know, history and women's studies, but now I've started up this microlending thing and I help start businesses. So I think that university needs to be a place where there's free thinking, where there's critical thinking, where we learn to ask good hard questions, because that's what's going to make the world better, not just the commercialization of ideas. So it's an and I think you're absolutely right. More people need to have access to that place where we learn critical thinking.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Lisa, you say that about the liberal arts degree, because I have a poll here. It's from Brainstorm from last year, and it says something about how students are more motivated to go to university because they're job-oriented. They want to make sure that they get a job when they get out of school. And so that 57% want, you know, that's the primary reason they're at university. So the desire to pursue advanced study was 18%, and only 14% who wanted to seek to develop themselves personally. So that primary goal of sort of being a well-rounded individual seems to be the lowest priority for these young students. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that in part because of the messaging we're giving them?
Well,
I think
it's in part because of the commercialization of everything.
Well, yeah. And a number of other things. I think this is a topic we're definitely going to return to in our second hour, because
Great.
It gets to the whole issue of, you know, perceptions out there of the post-secondary education system on the part of the consumers, which is the parents and the students. And are we maybe not doing a good enough job of explaining that there is a system and every piece of it has value, which is something we're going to talk to about our next guest about. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
From torn-out magazine ads to quick snapshots taken with a camera phone, the designers at Lux Home Interiors have had customers bring in all kinds of inspirational ideas when creating a new room or shopping for a single piece of furniture. Start a collection of imagery that inspires you and bring it with you when you wander through the ever-changing Lux showroom at the corner of Douglas and Hillside. Our design consultant's passion is to bring your home furnishing ideas to life. To help get your inspiration collection started, visit Lux Home Interiors website at yourstyleyourway.ca.
Please join me, Dr. Harlow Hollis, and the Dermaspot team for our 13th anniversary celebration. Stop by our open house from 3 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, September the 27th, where you will enjoy refreshments, mini spa treatments, and live demonstrations. You will also be entered to win exciting hourly prizes and a chance to win our grand prize valued at $2,500.
Attend Dermaspa's 13th anniversary celebration open house at 1830 Oak Bay Avenue or visit them online at dermaspa.ca for more info.
You were right. Kayaking is excellent.
You know what else is great? That whale.
What?
Don't panic. It's way the heck out there. You'll be fine.
Ah!
Sorry, dude.
I'm good. I'm all good. No worries.
Some things are closer than you think, like the JBI Pub and Restaurant at the James Bay Inn. Come by for breakfast, lunch, or dinner and experience great homestyle cooking with fresh ingredients made from scratch. The JBI Pub and Restaurant at the James Bay Inn. Really good. Really close. Corner of Government and Toronto.
Many things have changed, but McCall Brothers funeral directors know people still need to gather and support each other when a death occurs. That's why they've kept with the times and have updated their reception center. Designed to honor and celebrate life, the center is fully catered, can accommodate small or large gatherings, and has ample parking. All arrangements can be made at McCall's Downtown or McCall's West Shore, Jacqueline at Souk Road. McCall's Reception Center, helping to honor and celebrate a life. Visit McCallBros.com.
Save thousands at Saunders Subaru during the 2012 Subaru Fleet and Courtesy Car Sale on now. Save on the tough, all-weather capable, great handling 2012 Forester or the 2012 Legacy featuring standard all-wheel drive, big car comfort, and lively performance. Drive a deal on the 2012 Outback. Its versatility and high-end options will make you happy. The Saunders Subaru Fleet and Courtesy Car Sale. Hurry in for the best selection. Saunders Subaru on the Old Island Highway. The coffee's always on.
Give us 10 minutes and we'll give you the world. Victoria's first choice for information, news that matters. If it's happening, it's here. Victoria's News Authority, CFAX 1070.
Welcome back. You're listening to Sunday Morning Public Affairs on CFAX 1070, Victoria's News Authority. As is too often the case when discussing post-secondary education, we've been talking a lot about universities. All public discussions tend to go there, which I'm sure does not make our next guest job any easier. Joining us by telephone is Catherine Lauren, president of Camosun College. Welcome to the show, Catherine, and thank you for being here.
Well, good morning, and thanks for the invitation.
We've got a number of people here in the studio, Catherine. I'm not going to bother introducing everyone because it would just be that much more confusing, but I'm not going to be the only person asking questions. Just wanted to give you a heads up on that. Let's start off with, what role do colleges play in the post-secondary system?
Well, the short answer is we're playing an increasingly more significant role, I think, in the post-secondary system. And I think the notion now that, you know, when we say post-secondary, granted, people used to associate immediately with universities, but I think we're seeing a move away from that notion. We're seeing a shift now, especially as we're seeing economic changes. We're seeing now an emphasis on having a skilled workforce, emphasis on job readiness. An emphasis on, gee, what's my return on investment when I graduate with that, you know, post-secondary degree? What do I do afterwards? Mm-hmm. And colleges actually are really, really good at providing graduates who are job ready. They hit the ground running. They have an applied training. They have advanced skills that will make them highly employable upon graduation. So that's become a real focus right now. So we're really seeing our role increase, I think, as, you know, as I say, as the economy is shifting and there's this real focus. Mm-hmm. We also know that we're predicting out till 2020 that there's going to be a real shortage. In other words, in terms of finding jobs, the demand, or the demand will exceed supply for qualified people to take on jobs.
Mm-hmm. One question, we've been talking a lot about how over the last 20 years, you know, the public or taxpayers' support of universities as a percentage of their operating costs has declined pretty significantly, you know, once between 80 and 85% now. You know, around 50%, and much more of the burden has been thrown onto students. Explain how colleges are funded by government, and how, to what extent, that is different from what's happened with universities.
So I can tell you how colleges are funded, I don't know precisely how universities are funded, although I think it's quite similar. Usually it's based on what we call the number of FTE, so mm-hmm. full-time equivalents, and oftentimes it's weighted depending on the program. So the funding can really change from institution between universities and colleges, but perhaps the most important piece here is that universities are able to charge higher tuition than colleges.
Mm-hmm.
So our funding is probably in the same realm as the university in terms of maybe between 50-55% of our operating budget would come from government.
Okay.
So we're looking at tuition revenue to offset those costs, as well as other kinds of revenue generation.
Okay, where do you get the rest of the money?
Well, that's an interesting question. So let's say, just for round figures, that we're getting 50-52% of our funding from government. So probably, these are really rough numbers, I would say maybe 30% of the remaining costs would come from tuition. And then there's another 20-25% where we have to be entrepreneurial, actually, to generate revenue. And so how do you do that? Well, there's a number of ways, and the universities would be doing a number of these initiatives as well. We look, for example, for international students because they pay higher tuition. We look at, certainly at Camosun, we're involved in continuing education and contract training. So we do some corporate training that brings in revenue. And, you know, we're increasingly asking our deans and directors to be more entrepreneurial in their thinking in terms of how they might be able to generate revenue for their schools. So it's a challenge.
Hey, Catherine, John Jurisic here. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Hi, John.
I owned a tech company in the 2000s. It was an online learning company. We did a bunch of work in the U.S. And when we talk about differing education systems, the corporate influence in the U.S. was huge. I recall being in conversations with school districts, departments of education, where corporations that were funding had direct impact on the curriculum, et cetera. And that's sort of a good portion of the earlier part of our show was the impact that non-student fee, non-government direct revenue impacts education. Talk about how you see that happening. Where is that going? Is that a problem when we start to move out of the more traditional modes of revenue for our post-secondary institutions?
So that's an interesting question. I just caught a little bit of your show before I joined you. So certainly the technology piece is very important. And, you know, we're seeing, for example, students showing up now who have grown up with technology, and there's certainly an expectation that we're going to be delivering content using technology because that's how our students of today are used to learning. So, you know, and a focus in college actually is really to be working very closely with community to ensure that we are relevant. So, for example, at Camosun, we have over 50 advisory committees that would be working with industry, working with small businesses to provide feedback to us to say, listen, this is what we need with our graduates out in the workplace. So that part of it is becoming increasingly more important. In terms of the technology, we want to be careful that the technology is not driving the delivery, but that it's supporting the delivery. So, and in terms of, you know, corporate influence, now if you're talking about donations and so on, that's quite different, and I just heard a little snippet of that conversation on your show. But I think corporations can really be helping us in terms of, for example, providing us with in-kind donations, equipment, for example, that we could be using to showcase some of the latest developments coming out of industry, to create labs and so on, and use us as guinea pigs, if you will, so that we can try out the new ideas. So I think that's a role that corporations can be influencing or working with colleges.
Catherine, I think it's Dale Gann here from the Tech Park. Good morning.
Good morning.
I think what you're saying is bang on. I think that your statement about, you know, you and your other post-secondary partners in the community have to have their ears attuned to what does business want, what are they looking for in talent, and in creating these test environments to help us as a neighborhood, as a community, develop our economy and create jobs and make things that are relevant and contribute to this beautiful place that we call the Capital Regional District of Victoria. So I think you're bang on about that. And I you know, Camosun College is absolutely a key institution in our community, and the things you're doing through PAC Sport and Tim Walczak. We just had Experience Tectoria out there exposing what the some of the students are doing in that facility. And I think your summary of how you're positioning the college and working with the community is great. I just think that we need to take that idea and leave it just at the Camosun environment and bring it broader into the greater Victoria environment. And we all got to get behind what you're doing.
The other thing, Catherine, it's Lisa Helps here, Victoria City Councillor, and I also run an organization called Community Microlending, which makes small loans to people in Greater Victoria who want to start small businesses but don't qualify for credit from banks. And one of the things that struck me while you were talking is something that we do with our entrepreneurs at Community Microlending, which is match them with mentors. And we've been talking a lot about corporate donors, corporate sponsors, but I think there's a real opportunity, and curious to know whether you're doing this at Camosun, particularly in the business school, about drawing on local talent, local business talent, and finding mentors to draw that, again, getting rid of that bubble between university and community. Is there a mentorship program? Are businesses engaged not only to provide donations and in-kind support and so on, but to really get students paired with people who are in the business that they want to go into? Is that something that you do at Camosun?
Sorry, Catherine, I just got to interject and say, let everyone know we've got about a minute left.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well,
okay. And then we're coming back.
Quick answer, Lisa, would be, now, I'm not sure that we actually have a mentorship program set up, but I can tell you that our business school has a number of these advisory committees, so we're working very closely with business folks. And we bring in folks from industry to meet and speak with the students on a regular basis. So in that way, the students are getting some contact with those folks. We also have co-op programs, so our students are going out into the business community and having opportunity to work and then come back to finish their studies. So we have a number of initiatives underway. The whole concept of a mentorship, though, and a discrete mentorship program is a very interesting one and something that we should probably look at.
Yeah. Very quickly, Dale.
Just this week, we announced the BC Accelerator Network, and the major plank of that is a province-wide mentor program. So under the BC Innovation Council, a publicly funded entity, there is a mentor council. UVic has a business mentor council. Mentors are absolutely paramount.
Yes.
And I know the college is working with a whole bunch of folks, including the university, and let's keep driving that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's critical.
Well, Catherine, I thank you very much. It was very short, very brief, but
there's
very intense.
We could discuss.
But, I think as everyone is coming to appreciate, there's a lot to discuss on this topic, and I think we can all expect that.
And celebrate.
And when we come back after the news, we're going to talk, and I know that both Danielle and Lisa will want to talk about this. We're going to talk a little bit more about how we give everyone the opportunity to participate in this.